Blog Talk Radio.
Can only mean one thing. It is time once again for the Two Guys Soccer Show, and we are brought to you this week, as we are every week, by the fine folks at Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for live entertainment. And it is time to thank them for sponsoring what can only be considered to be the worst podcast in all of sports. I'm Mike. I'm one of the two guys. I am joined, as always, by my partner in crime, Stead. How you doing this evening?
I'm doing all right. How you doing this evening?
I'm fine, and it was a good week this week. The Chiefs won their first Super Bowl in 50 years.
Yes,
about as long as it's been since Liverpool last lost a game in the Premier League. The U.S. men sent a group of boys to do a man's job, and they proved that you can win something but with kids. But if less than 9,000 people watch a game, did it really happen?
Yeah, I'm going for no.
Yeah. Cristiano has scored 50 and 70 for Juve, but he doesn't have the same scoring record right now as a 19-year-old for Borussia Dortmund. And we're shocked, I tell you, to learn that Bayern and Juve are leading their respective leagues. But the most important thing that we have to talk about is the fact that I got the call on the Wolves-Manchester United game correct last week. And considering how much I mess up on a weekly basis, I'm going to give myself a pat on the back. So, everything good with you this week, brother?
Yeah, man. Doing all right. Couple of things I noticed was just that I'm not sure when this Liverpool train is going to stop. But the good thing about it is I have to say that, number one, I'm happy that my prediction is going to come true. But number two, I find it awfully funny that the league I said that was going to be the only competitive league in Europe has proven to be the only league in Europe that is not competitive at this time. So let's kind of like roll that one up in a burrito and eat that for a while.
Well, hey, look, if we get 50% of the predictions that we make right on this show, get 50% of the predictions right that we make on this show, then we are doing well. We are joined this week by Coach G. How you doing,
Coach
my
G?
Friend?
Coach G. I'm doing well, gentlemen. How you guys doing today?
We're doing great. So, without further ado, let's get it started with some stuff that happened relatively recently. Something is rotten in the state of Catalonia. Lionel Messi has, well, is it really breaking your silence if you don't actually talk? But Lionel Messi has taken to Instagram and unleashed a uncharacteristic rant directed at Eric Abidal, the director of football for Barcelona, who had an interview last week talking where he insinuated that some of the senior players at this club, including Lionel Messi, were responsible for Ernesto Valverde being sacked. And this is really uncharacteristic of Messi because he doesn't normally say much of anything publicly, especially not about Barcelona. And even more interesting was the fact that it kind of came on the heels of an article that I was reading yesterday. I'm not sure whether it was published yesterday, but it was published recently on ESPN about, you know, the slide that Barcelona is on and how They're just not signing big coaches, and the players just have all this power in the club. And Messi, along with PK and Javier Mascherano, are basically running the show, and they're the ones that are making the calls as far as coaching and transfers. And it went as far as to say, like, the club just was basically trying to appease Messi with the Neymar pursuit, and they kind of were just going through the motions. And it was really interesting. And I wanted to get your thoughts on what you on this situation. Could this be the end for Messi? Is Abidal going to have to suck crow and offer a humble apology and possibly even fall on his sword and leave the club? Where does Barca go from here? Because certainly everything is not right for the Blaugrana right now.
I am. Of course, contracts mean everything. Contracts mean everything. And Messi can walk at the end of this year if he wants to. He has this sort of, and I know that Barcelona's basically kind of made mentions of the fact that it would be easy to pull off a lifetime deal with Messi to keep him there for the rest of his life, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know, it seemed like that sort of rubbed him the wrong way when you started to hear those reports. And yes, of course, I'm speculating here because, as you said, Messi doesn't say much of anything really at all. But those who are somewhat connected with him have said that that was not something that he may have appreciated. And he's wants to be, of course, he's always seems to be like wants to be a player on the squad. But he also has the ability to probably just extend his current deal, which is the most lucrative deal, like, for a single contract in, I believe, in Europe. He can just extend his deal 1 year, 1 year, 1 year, 1 year, and he can kind of hold Barcelona by their respective testicles, if you want to say. I think it's a little bit of posturing here, especially with considering it's Abidal, who Messi played with for a number of years, who's also a relative club legend there. So, not all is well there. It's clearly something's wrong with the front office. Especially when you were talking about coaches, and I noticed when they brought in the most recent coach, this is kind of the first time in a long time where I was quite unfamiliar with an incoming Barcelona coach. I can't say that's happened to me very, very much recently. So, yeah, all is not right in the water. I really think that Abidal's probably going to have to eat a little bit of crow here, because I think with Barcelona's slide and with the, I don't want to say there's unrest amongst the fans as far as their support of their team is concerned, but it's not a bad idea to think that he should, that if the fans had to pick between Messi or a stronger front office, I think they'd pick Messi.
Coach G, why don't you chime in on this?
Yeah, I agree. I think that he said. I actually watched a special last night about Messi, and he does a lot of things behind the scene, obviously within the club itself. But he's just a spoiled little player. This documentary I was watching more or less said that he drove out Ibram from Barcelona. He was only there for 1 year. That Messi had a complex that Ibram was going to take over the team and be a better player. It seems that he holds a lot of weight, and yeah, the fans would actually back him up. All the trophies and the accolades that Messi brought to Barcelona, and yes, he's still one of the top two, top three players in the world right now. I can see the fans, agreeing with Messi and, maybe changing up the front office. And I agree, this new coach right now, I know we'll talk about Atletico coach a little later, but the new coach right now, I don't see really anything special about him. I did some research. I have no idea who this guy was. And I think with the Atletico, with Simone, I think he might be even a better fit with Barcelona. He's got that little fire, which I like as a coach, and that's what I do as myself. I can see him maybe taking over at the end of the season. But definitely the front office and the coaching staff need to be shaken up right now. They have excellent players, but something's just not clicking. Especially with now Dembele being hurt, and he might be out for a while, that throws into another question mark for the overall this squad for 19-20 years. So we'll see what happens with the Barcelona, but definitely not the Barcelona from old. I'll say that much.
Yeah, Dembele unfortunately going down with yet another season-ending injury. Mm-hmm. Looks like a torn hamstring. So We wish him a speedy recovery, but it's a shame because it's such a promising young player who just has had an awful time with injury and inconsistency since he got there and has at times displayed the sort of potential that led them to sign him. After Neymar left as ostensibly the Neymar replacement, you can see what they saw in him coming from Borussia Dortmund, but he's yet to display it on the field. As far as the front office goes, you know, it's an interesting time because this is as close, I think, as Messi has ever come to interjecting himself into the politics of the club. And there's a presidential election, which at Barca coming up this summer, which could, you know, alter the club. If Laporte wins election again, it'll go in one direction. But you could see this as sort of a tipping point where another candidate could come in and say, look, I'm going to secure Messi. We have a great relationship. I'm going to right this ship. And that could be sort of this is the first time where it even hints at Messi saying that he wants a change at the top of the club publicly. We don't know what he said privately because he doesn't say much anything that we hear firsthand. Now, Coach D, you brought up Diego Simeone, who is off to a torrid start, and we'll talk about that situation in a second. But the article I was reading was interesting insofar as it said, you know, since Louis van Gaal, who was the last coach really of note that Barca have signed, what they've done is they've identified the style of football they want to play and then gone out and gotten the coach to get it. And they've eschewed big-name coaches. You know, they could have had Jose Mourinho when they hired Pep Guardiola, but they went with Pep Guardiola, who, despite becoming a legend at the time, was just the B-team coach. You know, his handpicked successor was Tito Villanova. We know what happened there. And then it's just been this steady stream of coaches that have been brought in essentially to learn the style of play for Barcelona and make sure they play that way, rather than coming in and saying, hey, maybe we should try and do things differently. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to the amount of weight that, A, the club's history has. You know, when they talk about the former players and coming in and saying, like, this is how we're going to play and being consulted on the style of football and who should be the coaches and consulting the current players as well on transfers and stuff like that, you do have a little bit of feeling that it's the inmates running the asylum, and maybe now, as this current generation has gotten a little bit longer in the tooth, you know, none of them are on the plus side or on the good side of 30 right now. Most of them are on the negative side of 35, and we're looking at the tail end of the careers of the likes of Mascherano and Messi and Piqué. They have not been able to effectively identify and indoctrinate replacements for these players. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens moving forward, because anything short of a Champions League win, I think, for Barca this season will be seen as a failure. And I don't think any of us are confident that Quique Setién can get it done. But
no. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be quite a mountain. That'd be quite an ask for a guy, and to come in and essentially knock off two clubs that are right now much more consistent in Europe right now. You're looking at Real Madrid and Liverpool. So the especially when you got there in January, I mean, you're still dusting off your unpacking your suitcase. So that does reek of inmates running the asylum, and if you know, I don't think it's out of bounds to see Barcelona being knocked out in the round of eight, the quarters. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily – I don't think that would surprise anybody. I hope. I'm not even – I'm not sure the round of 16 opponent is off the top of my head, but I just – I don't think that would come as a big of a shock. I think there would be lots of questions to be asked. There would be lots of speculation on on the decisions that the front office is making and go on, goes into the points that all three of us have made. But I don't think the shock would be there. I think it would be this is what happens when teams end up in this situation. So they have to rectify this immediately, or else this is their opportunity to kind of supplant Real Madrid as the, you know, the most valued franchise in the world. This is really their opportunity. And if that's something that they value and if that's something they want to move forward to, it's kind of like this is our league now, because Real Madrid was just, you know, kind of falling out of favor and you weren't hearing so much about them. And now you look up and they're equal on wins and they've only lost one game this whole season in La Liga. You can see Real Madrid just stomping them back down again, going, okay, that was fun for you guys for a while. As soon as Messi's gone, we're going to take back over this whole league, and you're going to, you know, hopefully you can climb out of it again.
All right. Coach, you got a last word on this one?
Yeah, and last couple of weeks, you know, Real Madrid has just been slowly sneaking up under the radar, and while all the chaotic stuff happening for Barca, you know, everything's being consistent right now. The coaching staff, you know, Zidane is back and stuff like that. Like, they've just been just waiting for their moment, and they're just trusting the system. They're trusting everything, and here they are now 3 points ahead. Things look better for Real Madrid. However, you can never really count out Barcelona. But I think all the turmoil, all the stuff right now in Barcelona is going to – they're going to lose. They're going to drop a couple points here and there. So it might be Real Madrid's, you know, chance to get first place in La Liga this year.
Well, you spoke of Real Madrid. They were 1-0 victors in the Madrid derby, and you also spoke, Coach, about Diego Simeone and the torrid time that he's having. They're sitting 3 points – they're sitting six in the league, 3 points off of a Champions League spot, and 13 points off the current league leaders, Real Madrid. Are we really seeing the beginning of the end of Diego Simeone at Atletico Madrid? And is this sort of a Klopp-like end and similar to what Jurgen went through in his last season with Borussia Dortmund? I can see a lot of parallels there where you have a team that, well, big isn't necessarily as financially powerful as some of the other teams in its league, and a coach that has a very strong personality and whose message can start to wear thin on players. And finally, a team that has been consistently selling its top players and not being able to find necessarily the like-for-like replacements. You know, Joao Felix is a tremendously talented player, but he's out injured right now and he's yet to be able to find form and slide in like we thought he was going to, but it's a change in league, it's a change in system. And for a guy who's in his late his 1920, it's a big change to move from Portugal into La Liga and be asked to carry the goal scoring load for a Champions League contender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Felix has been also rumored to go to Juve right now too. So is this kind of the end of Atletico? You know, they have great players there, but Morata's the lead goal scorer right now. But he only has 7 goals. Their goal production is way down right now. So I don't know if it's the system or, like you said, they just maybe had enough of Simone, but things don't look good. You know, they have Koke there, they have Felix, they have Diego Costa there, they have Morata, they have Kieran Trippier. You know, they have a lot of big names, but they're not producing. So it could be a little slide for them to see to maybe see a new coaching change. But I wouldn't be surprised if Felix says, hey, I'm out, you know, send me over to somewhere else, send me to Juve, send me over maybe to Barcelona. But maybe Atletico is on the way down right now. They're in sixth place, so we'll see. We'll see what happens, man.
Yeah, I think it's kind of sad, you know. I think it's sad. Atletico was the, you know, kind of the darling for a while. It was that third club that was really causing a lot of problems, and not just in La Liga, but in Europe. And I agree, to put that much pressure on such a young kid as to be the primary goal scorer. I mean, I think people have to understand Kylian Mbappe is a once-in-a-lifetime type of talent that can come in and actually be your leading scorer at such a young age. That does not happen very often, and it's not very consistent. So, but, you know, Coach G, you're exactly right. This is a talented team. Quite talented team, and they have dropped some games recently against clubs that really cannot match. They really should not be able to match up with them. I mean, they even drew against the club that had a red card. So So in their last outing. So one of the last outings, excuse me. So sometimes you just have to bring in a new person to give a new message. You know, we can think about things of American football where a coach may can't necessarily get a team over the line, and they bring in a new coach and he takes that old team's player, old coach's players, and is able to win, you know, championships. So it could be that they need to bring in a different coach with a different message to kind of like coach these players a bit better. And Simeone may be the guy to come and take over one of the even bigger clubs. Maybe he's feeling like Atletico Madrid is not necessarily at the level that he'd like to be at. Maybe he'd like to be at a club that isn't necessarily of the that's not going to be on the top 15 for the Forbes Most Valuable Franchise list. You know, so and of course I'm throwing spitballs at the topic right now, but I'm more speaking of what we've seen throughout history. And yes, it does reek very much of Jurgen Klopp. And, you know, I don't think that he definitely hasn't kind of like the wind in his sails hasn't ended for him to be a successful manager. It just may be it's time for him to move on from Atletico, because we could easily see him going to another club and being a dominant coach for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I think if this is the end, and if at the end of this they decide to part ways, you have to look back, number one, and say, the tenure was successful. Two Champions
Absolutely.
League finals.
Absolutely successful.
Two
yeah.
league titles.
Europa.
You know,
Europa League.
Bringing, and
yep.
most importantly
Copa
for the
Rey.
Future of the club, opening up that new stadium, which will help
mm-hmm.
financially secure them for another generation.
Mm-hmm.
There will be any
mm-hmm.
number of clubs right now who would line up to take Diego Simeone for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, if that was what you were going to get out of him.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of two of them right now that we would run with the Brinks truck to his doorstep and say, hey, what is it going to take to get you to manage this club? So we'll keep watching that. Moving
mm-hmm.
over to across a little bit north to Germany. Bayern Munich have once again taken the league in the Bundesliga, but I think the story in Germany right now is one 19-year-old Norwegian, Erling Bruten Haaland, who
mm-hmm.
has had an absolutely remarkable start to his career at Borussia Dortmund with now 8 goals in 4 games. He picks up a goal, his 8th, since he made his debut today in a German Cup loss to Werder Bremen, a 3-2 loss. But he was on the score sheet, and he was joined there by one Gio Reyna,
mm-hmm.
American son of Claudio, who is getting some
mm-hmm.
time. So what do we think of Haaland at Borussia Dortmund right now? Stead?
To say this is not exciting is completely ridiculous. I mean, he is big, which is pretty cool. You know, it's a big dude. And you look at him and you're like, I've never seen a more Norwegian looking person than this boy right here. But to be 19, 6'4", already starting to fill out, and he hasn't even really got, you know, he hasn't learned his body yet, this could be scary. And this kid could really, really be a dominant center forward. And you're thinking of the likes of a another sort of Scandinavian forward. You can think of our boy Ibrahimovic. You could see him having that type of career where he's just banging goals in left and right, and he's just really difficult for defenders to handle. I mean, unless he's going to be playing against Manchester United's back two every week, I don't really know who's going to be able to match up with his size-wise. So, and the fact, though, that also he's very familiar with, like, he grew up in England, you know, spent a lot of time in England. So he has this sort of really interesting development in the football world. And even, let's take Norway, for example. Norway hasn't been much on the international stage as of late, but we can recall they were qualifying for the World Cup in the 90s, and they were actually they they didn't get too far in 94, but they were there, and they were a team that was pretty close to qualifying on multiple occasions, as well as for the Euros. So this could be that player that reignites the Norwegian national team to get them back into being talked about more so on the international stage. But I think going to a club like Dortmund is a great move for him, because they've been a team that is not afraid to give these young footballers a chance to really shine. And also because it's kind of ingrained in the culture, that this is kind of what they do. I think it's easier for a player and to go in there and start right away and just go, hey, I'm just here to play and knock in some goals. And but seeing him playing with Sancho and with Gio Reyna, that's actually pretty exciting. And I think as an American soccer fan, I mean, Dortmund's kind of becoming the good team in Germany that Americans can follow, because they're also giving our players a chance as well. So it's exciting, and I'm really happy for them. I really hope that this turns into a really, really big deal.
You spoke of him making the decision to go to Dortmund. It was clear that he had the opportunity to go to Manchester United. It may have even been his preference.
I think he had the opportunity to go to Juventus as well.
He'll be there eventually.
The contract that he signed there, the more details that get released, there's a significant sell-on clause that would go to Mino Raiola when he leaves, and they inserted a £75 million release clause that kicks in after the summer of 2021, so next season, which basically only allows Dortmund to recoup what they've paid for him in transfer fee and salary, not to make any sort of significant profit. So is this a case of they made essentially a devil's bargain to get to rent this player, knowing that they were probably only going to have him for 2 years? What do you think, Coach G?
Yeah, I think so. He's going to be there for, like you said, 2 years. And I know the bigger clubs, Man U, some of the bigger English leagues, they're looking at him right now and drooling over his potential. Like you said, like him even and Sancho, both guys grew up in England. Now they're playing on the same team. They're both just have the potential through the roof. Whatever team's going to go for Highland, or however you say his last name, they're going to be paying through the roof for this potential guy. Again, he's 19 years old, 6'4", he's 190 right now, and he's slowly filling out. He is going to be a monster. He looks like right now, kind of like a Thomas Mueller. He's in the right place, right time, but this guy's just faster and stronger right now. His eye for goal is unbelievable. However, on the other hand, the teams that he did play to score all those goals were middle to lower tier in the Bundesliga. So let's see how he does when the teams have more of a scouting report on him, kind of shut him down a little bit. Let's see him playing against better defenses. But, yeah, the potential, it's through the roof. And, again, being 19 Norwegian, that might spark another new generation of Norwegians, you know, to pick up the ball again, to get back that 1990 and stuff like that
off,
in the World Cup.
Take the skis off.
But, you know, like him and Sancho, just watching Sancho just play, oh, my God, the team has got a lot of potential. If they can hold on to those two guys and just keep their core – like you said, they let the young guys play and develop, and that's half the battle of seeing what you have when you have them, kind of thing. And wow, it's exciting to see this City 2 teams play. And even Bayern's only up 1 point, and the top four that's separated by 3 points, so it's the tightest, you know, league of all of them. And maybe Erling and Sancho will just bring the Dortmund up to the next level, maybe beat Bayern this year again, hopefully. But yeah, it's exciting to see some young guys coming through here. I'm excited. So, supposed to be a Norwegian, so it kind of helps me out.
And in Italy, you know, the Juve back on top, Cristiano Ronaldo, 50 and 70, for Juventus. Is this an accomplishment that we should take note of, Stead?
No, I'm just putting it bluntly. It is. I can't get over the fact, though, that, you know, you got to look at who he's playing against week in and week out in Serie A, and you're seeing is how his contract alone is more than some teams in the bottom half of Serie A's entire squad. And, you know, scoring, it's just when you have the talent around him that he has, I'm taking his accomplishments in Italy with a little bit of a grain of salt, because if he's able to get Juve a Champions League, which has kind of been the title they struggled to get in throughout their history, has been the Champions League. Mm-hmm. So if he's able to get them a Champions League, then yes, I will applaud his move and add that in a cap to his greatness. But, you know, I can't say that I paid much attention to it, and I actually do try to follow Italian soccer relatively closely. It just seems, though, that because of the way Italy and Serie A have been for the past decade, it's a bit difficult to think this as a major accomplishment. But that I could change my mind if I see, you know, Inter Milan's making a lot of moves. You know, they're really putting together a squad that's looking like finally there's going to be some competition for that for the Serie A crown. So that's positive. That's positive. But, you know, I'm not taking anything away from it. But I'm also, I mean, it's not equivalent to his goal-scoring record in Real Madrid, but he was scoring over a goal a game for La Liga. So, but, you know, 50 goals in 70, it's impressive. I'd like to know how many of those are penalty kicks, because I tend to discount those. But, good for him. We'll see what happens in Europe with Juventus. But, again, I personally don't take it as such a big deal. Maybe if he was 19, I would, but the fact that he's already pretty well established at a very, very dominant team, I don't know. I'm just not quite there yet.
Now, it's interesting that Ronaldo's scoring record this year, he has 22 from 27 games played, Messi mm-hmm. at 19 from 24, and Kylian Mbappe's at 22 from 25.
Mm-hmm.
So, of those three players in different leagues, who's having the best season?
Factor in like age and stuff like that. And Ronaldo doing it at his age, and yeah, he's been, you know, a machine since, you know, back in the Man U days. You got to give him props, even though, you know, he's not the 22 and 25, but he's still producing numbers left and right, and he is still a target for many Juve attacks and everything. You got to give him credit, but kind of like what you said before with Inter Milan, like they're kind of stepping up their game because of it, but you have to tip your hat to Ronaldo right now in his age. Mbappe, if he can do that at his age, he'll probably be better, but when you're 21, 22 years old, you can run, you know, like with anyone and not feel any pain, or you can run the next day. But what Ronaldo's doing right now, you got to tip your hat off to him.
So, yeah, I have to agree. You do have, I will say this, though. I will say who's his least impressive, and that is Mbappe, because he plays in Ligue 1. That's the least impressive one.
Such a weak league, too.
Speaking of Mbappe and PSG, Angel Di Maria made some comments about the fact that they're doing what they have a sizable league in PSG in Ligue 1, and everybody's saying, oh, that's because the league stinks. Whereas Liverpool are running away with the Premier League and everybody's talking about how great they are, as if to say, like, can PSG get some credit? I think the consensus is until you win the Champions League, no. But it's been an interesting couple of days for PSG. Saturday, they beat Montpellier 5-0. Mbappe on the score sheet. He was substituted early by Thomas Tuchel, and there was clearly a bust-up between the two of them. And he's been very hesitant to sign a contract. And, of course, everybody's now taking that as an indication that he wants to go to Real Madrid, who have made no bones about the fact that they would like to sign him. After the game, Neymar had his 28th birthday party, which was a big all-white affair at a very popular nightclub in Paris. You can go and look at the pictures on the Instabook face if you'd like to. They're all over there. But he was then unable to play today against Nantes because he had an injured wrist. So what do we make of the situation in Paris?
Well, if you saw who did not show up to his party, Mbappe. He didn't go.
Mbappe
was actually doing a charity event for a former player.
Matuidi.
Blaise Matuidi, yeah. And so he was not there. And, you know, you can speculate what you want about what that means, but it's just kind of funny that when Neymar is at a party, a birthday party to celebrate himself, and Mbappe goes to an event that's on the same day, which I'm sure he was already scheduled for, but it just happens to be a charity event. I mean, optics look wonderful for Mbappe, especially after the dust up he just recently had with Tuchel. Now, I think it would be idiotic for Mbappe to not strongly consider leaving PSG. Yes, PSG will not get the credit that maybe they even deserve because they play in Ligue 1, and you don't see any other team in that league in recent history have any sort of success in Europe, nor have they really outside of Monaco once, and that's when Mbappe was on that squad, had any other teams had any real success in that league. So to compare it to Liverpool, I think Premier League's probably a little down this year, but also Liverpool's winning a lot of games 1-0 or 2-1 or getting help from VAR, as we all like to say on the text line. But also, you know, PSG's still winning 2-0, 3-1, 4-1, 5-1, 6-0. You know, they're still dominating their league like you're not going to see in the Premier League. So I think it's wise for Mbappe to not necessarily show the antics that he showed when he was being subbed out. But, yes, it is wise for him to really strongly consider leaving Paris, go to Real Madrid. You will be the biggest star in the world, and he should strongly be considering that.
What do you think, Coach G?
Well, I cringed once you said Monaco and Mbappe. My first thought was they beat Arsenal.
I know. I was hoping you wouldn't bring it up, Coach.
The tears started kind of going down. But the BPL right now, Liverpool is running away. I think it's tougher this year because it seems like anyone could beat anyone, and anyone could beat Arsenal as well. But it seems like it's kind of the more evenly matched, but yet Liverpool's on another just wavelength. Like, they're the best team in the whole world whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
But PSG, they're up by a huge margin right now. You know, Neymar can sit for a while. They'll still kind of win 1-0, maybe draw here and there. It's such a weak, weak league. And you're absolutely right. In any other European contest, no one is really splashing the pot that Marseille back they did. Lyon back in the day did, but nothing recently, not within the last 10 years. So I can see Mbappe saying, you know what, I'm out of here. I want more of a challenge. I want more something. You know, I'm a big star. Yeah, it's cool to win this league, but it's a weak league. So maybe going to Real Madrid, Barcelona, Man U, anywhere might be a better fit because bigger team name and more competition. No, I think he's the type of player that really wants to solidify himself as one of the top five, if not the top, three of all, not all time, but currently. And he can do that, but on that team, I don't see it, and that's why I kind of think he might be on his way out. You know, and then the coach and the coaching staff and kind of going back and forth. Is Neymar going back to Barcelona? There's a lot of question marks right now just for PSG. I think Mbappe, he's got his time ticking right now. I give him another year or two, and he's done.
The fact that they could both leave this year and go to Real Madrid and Barcelona from PSG, is this sort of proof that the experiment at PSG is limited in how successful it can be? And by that, I mean they have signed some big players.
But
they seem to have been unable to keep them. We saw Zlatan say, basically, I have proven everything that I needed to prove. Neymar, get me out of here. Mbappe, starting to fall out of love with it. It's just that by nature of them playing, the players are realizing that, look, we cannot be successful. The quality of life is great. The pay is great. But we want to win Champions League. We've got to go someplace else.
And go ahead. I'm sorry.
They chase the money over there.
Yeah.
If they want to throw millions and millions of dollars, why wouldn't you play over there? Get a couple of trophies and go somewhere else. So they're kind of doing a tryout for these bigger teams right now.
I'm looking at the race for the European Golden Shoe. And despite the season that Kylian Mbappe is having, he is listed because of the formula that they use, which weights goals in certain leagues more than others. He's currently sitting in 12th behind the likes of Romelu Lukaku, Jamie Vardy, and Wissam Ben Yedder.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, it's been no secret. I've made it no secret my opinions on the quality of the league. And has the experiment worked? I'm going to say push, mainly because I don't feel like it's the fault of the people. It's not the fault of the owners of the squad. They have built a phenomenal squad. They really have. But I think it's just the fault of the league. The league just is not at the level where they're going to get the competition they need so they can actually compete strongly with the other dominant teams in Europe. I mean, you could take any Champions League squad that qualifies from Spain or from England and from Germany, and I would pick them over PSG week in and week out in Champions League, especially in the knockout stages. I would. And I said this last year and the year before, I'm going to keep saying this until they prove me wrong, and they haven't been able to. But you're looking at Cavani's been trying to get out of there for a year and a half as well. He's been trying to leave. So, you know, it's PSG cannot be a Juventus or Bayern Munich type of team because the remainder of the league is not at a point that can support their success. It's just not going to happen. I mean, if you're doing pull-ups and then in one room and doing pull-ups with a weight around your waist in the other room, you're going to get stronger, even though you're both doing pull-ups. It's just not going to work. So I feel for PSG in a way where I'm going, I just don't think you're going to be able to be successful in the way you thought, and there's really nothing you can do about it. So I think the owners of PSG, best thing they can do is entice some of their other very wealthy friends to buy some other teams in France and hopefully influx the same cash so they could at least have two or three other teams that make that league worthwhile to watch.
Well, they tried.
And they even thought Neymar. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, go ahead, coach, and then I'll make my point.
They thought like throwing a bunch of money to Neymar that Neymar would bring him to that next level. I haven't seen it. I have not seen any really, truly overall big improvement. So I think it's a ship that's been sinking. They try to patch it up with a Neymar hole, and it's not working.
They tried that with another player. They tried to invest money in Monaco, and they found out that was going to work because of the tax system over there.
Right.
There's just not
enough
money in the French league.
You just can't do
to
it.
To make it profitable. And
right.
You can't do it. And I would say the experiment, like you said, it's been a push. Certainly the Neymar experiment, he still has yet to, since he's been there, play a knockout round game for PSG in the Champions League. And we continue to see antics like this. Whether or not he had a rib injury that prevented him from playing that he picked up in the game and then went to his birthday party or not, certainly we have to talk about another PR optics fail for Neymar. Fact that you have this last party and then you can't turn up for your job very publicly a couple of days later. This is just another example of, I want to say, that it's sort of like the immaturity to realize, like, this is not a good look for me. You know, even if I have to put out a statement that's like, I injured my ribs in the game, I'm not going to be able play something that comes out before the party so that it's not looking like, oh, you spent so much time celebrating your 28th that you weren't able to turn up for the game that you needed to play a few days later.
The optics couldn't be worse. And the thing is, you're right. Like Neymar's had problems with this since he's really come onto the scene in Europe. He's really had an issue with his ability to keep the negative press off of him. And it's really because
he likes that, though.
I think he likes it. And it's just kind of funny because you're looking at it going, he has to be aware by now that this is going to look really bad. And I'm wondering if he revels in it a little bit.
I think he likes the publicity, but the eyes on him.
Yeah, and you know, I hate saying that he's just a me guy and only cares about, you know, how, you know, his own thing. But we don't really know if what he's doing in his personal life is really all that detrimental. I mean, he could have gone to his party and drank water and soda all night and, you know, just hung out for a while and went home. You know what I mean? He may not have actually had some rager, and he may have been very well injured. But, again, he doesn't do the things that are necessary to keep that narrative to a minimum. He just doesn't do them, and it's too late now. 28 in soccer years is much older than 28 in, I think, from American sports perspective. 28 is – you've been a pro for 14 or 12 to 14 years by the time you're 28. A lot of these guys are starting at, you know, 14, 15, 16. So,
oh, I mean,
you haven't learned this
playing
by...
for Santos as a teenager. So yeah. He's been playing for over a decade.
Yeah. So if you haven't learned this by now, you know, you may never see a knockout stage in Champions League again. So I don't want to say that he is or is not doing the right things, but yes, the optics could not be worse for him.
Coach.
I agree. You know, watching that special, you know, yesterday on the big players, they said he's been bankrupt several times in his life already. So he's it seems like a type of guy that's about me, want to show off all this type of stuff. You know, I'm sorry, but any other job, if you don't show up because of whatever, because you're partying, you probably won't have a job again. But since it's him, you know, PSG gave him a bunch of money, he's just kind of maybe laughing in their face. He loves, you know, the negative attention. It's all about me. I'm in the news. You know, is he trying to sabotage his image or get out of PSG? Would PSG and their fans, you know, boo him out of Paris? I've heard that too, that, you know, the PSG fans have a lot of weight to throw them out of Paris. So is he going down that route to just give Barcelona a better chance to pick him up again or another big top team? But I don't know. It just seems like he's doing a lot of the wrong things at the wrong time. And again, you can be so bored winning every single game in the French league, but it's not really doing anything overall for the Champions League or anything else. So maybe he's just kind of not satisfied, but he's satisfied because he gets away with all this stuff. And the other team would maybe hold him more accountable and maybe would sit him more or do whatever. But I think PSG is kind of, you know, handcuffed with him. So we'll see what happens next game, the next couple of games, see what comes out of what his injuries or anything like that. So. Put a question mark on right now on my thoughts on him and PSG.
So I want to take a moment and pause real quick. This first however long we've been on has absolutely flown by, and give a big shout out to our sponsor, as always, Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for live sports and entertainment, and the only place in the Delaware, Maryland, Virginia area that will be showing the Six Nations Rugby Tournament live over the next couple of weeks. Huge one this coming Saturday as Wales travels to the Aviva to take on Ireland. Should be a good time. Go and check it out on the big screen. And you can do that because the Premier League is on their winter break. Switching to people who are not on a winter break, and I want to make sure that I give enough time to have this conversation. One of the advantages of not doing the show last night was that I got to actually sit and watch the U.S. Women's Olympic qualifier against Costa Rica, which they won down outside of Houston 6-0 to move on to the semifinals of that tournament and take the next step to going to Brazil. And as I was initially writing down my show notes, I was impressed. You know, they picked up a 4-0 win over Haiti and an 8-0 win over Panama before taking out Costa Rica 6-0. And I realized that, you know, the competition for women's soccer in CONCACAF is not exactly the greatest, and that we should have
That's an understatement if I've never heard one.
Right.
But I had some question marks. You know, it's a 20-woman roster down from the 25 that they carried to the World Cup. I was actually on my notes have who's going to score all the goals going forward, because if, you know, Alex Morgan is pregnant and she will be expecting to deliver right before the start of the Olympics. I think like 2 months would be when she was due. And I was questioning, like, where are the goals going to come from? Because Carly Lloyd's getting a little bit older. It doesn't seem like they're having much of a problem. But as I was watching this game, I was struck by just, like, how clinical this team is, how they just continue to take apart competition, game in, game out. Is it time to seriously look at the U.S. women's team and put them in the conversation for most dominant national team of any gender, full stop?
Yeah, you can.
Look at the
numerous coaches they've had over the years, and they've all been just producing just outstanding players and outstanding teams. Yeah, when you talk about Pelé in Brazil, why not? You know, they're so dominant for so long right now, and steady. Every person off the bench is scoring. You know, old ladies are retiring, having kids, and people who are replacing them are still stepping up. Like, they have not dropped. Completely down the team. But again, they're women. They don't get that much notoriety, but why not? Why can't you put them with the famous Brazil teams back in the day and everything? No one's really caught up to them. Yeah, maybe France might get a win here and there, and England and Spain's coming up, and Germany's pretty good. But besides that, they're dominating, and they're dominating their B teams against Costa Rica and Haiti and everyone else. It's, you know, it's watching, you know, the pros versus, you know, JUCO teams. We should actually appreciate this time right now of this, because we don't know how long it's going to last, but wow, this seems unbelievable.
We talk about the competition and we chuckle about the difference in the level of competition in between the U.S. women and some of the people that they face, at least in this region, and then some of the some of the teams that they'll face in the early rounds of tournaments. You know, you're going to have those Thailand games and stuff like that. And I was thinking back and reflecting on teams like Spain and the dominant Spain team of the late aughts with Xavi and Iniesta and Pique, the one that won back-to-back Euros around a World Cup title. And it wasn't like that team was playing the toughest of competition week in, week out, especially in qualifiers. We've had this conversation on the show about the quality of competition in European qualifiers, where, yeah, you might have to play a Great Britain or Wales or France, depending on the group stage, but you're also going to get games against Andorra and the Faroe Islands and Gibraltar.
They're my favorite.
You know, so you're going to look at some of the competition. And I remember in the second European finals when they took on Ireland. Now, no disrespect to Ireland, and it was a lot of fun going out there and watching that, but they took them apart 3-0, and the only thing that the Irish fans could think to do was start singing Fields of Athenry. They understood what they were watching. Are we dismiss the U.S. women's dominance capriciously and say they don't have to play anybody? But at the same time, we say that about the men's teams. Oh, they don't really have to play anybody, and we condemn European and World Cup qualification in Europe and say that there's a lot of teams that don't need to be in it, but we praise these teams as being great. And I'm thinking, like, it just seems like an obvious double standard to me.
You know what? If there was actually the level of other teams that could compete, then I would agree with you. But I still don't feel like on the world stage there's basically two or three teams, and one of them always happens to be the United States. And I also just you don't – until I see another country that actually puts the investment into the sport for the young women who play it in those countries, I'm just not – it's very difficult for me to I don't want to say accept their dominance, but it's difficult for me to put it on the same level as you know, a Brazil team from the 50s and 60s, or even the recent Spain team, mainly because through no fault of their own, women's sports are not adequately funded in several places throughout the world, because you're seeing a lot of these women that are playing for the national side, as you said, you know, on multiple occasions, Mike, who come here to play collegiate soccer. And on the flip side, you're looking at the women's leagues that are coming up in England and France, and what they're doing right is that they're offshoots of established clubs. So it would be like having a Philadelphia Union that also has a women's squad, and the DC United that has a women's squad, which you're not seeing in the United States because the support for the club game just isn't really there. And if that occurred, you might, I think maybe you'd see more support for the women's game in the United States outside of the national team. But because of the way that the American people will get behind a squad that happens to be winning in any sort of international tournament, regardless of how they feel about the sport, is one reason why the U.S. team is quite popular in the United States, mainly just because they win. But also it's because the investment has been made in them to be successful in a sport where they saw early on, wait a minute, we can be dominant in this. Let's go ahead and flood this. So it's, again, I'm not faulting anyone, but I just have a hard time saying that they are super dominant because the game just hasn't really been around long enough. Ask me when I'm 70, I might think differently. But this also reeks of, you know, the Canadian national hockey team. When hockey was first beginning international competitions in the earlier part of the 20th century, they were outscoring, they were winning tournaments by scoring 110 goals and giving up 3 goals. So the I feel like it's at this particular stage, and now you're seeing all these other countries go, oh, we should try this too. So let's give these other countries a chance a bit more to kind of like get more on the ball and maybe get some investment in the game. Granted, I don't think that's going to really change anything. I think the U.S. women are going to continue to dominate the way they're currently dominating, but it just would be nice to see a little bit more of an investment in the world game. It'll at least get it to the level of, like, rugby, where you got 10 countries that are really good.
Well, this tournament, again, will be interesting. We suspect that the U.S. will get by presumably Mexico, who would be the second place team in Group B, and play Canada. The winner, once you get to the semifinals, both teams qualify. It'll be a little bit of a different tournament. Great Britain announced in October that they would field a team, a combined Great Britain team, which was eligible because of England's finish in the Women's World Cup. They had not done that. I think, A, this puts an end to a conversation that we were wondering about after the end of the World Cup, whether Great Britain would do it. I wonder if there was anything in there that said, we have to do this because if we don't and we say we're not going to, France automatically qualifies. So it was a great way for them to give a backhand up yours to France.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. That was good.
No, I want, because they did not do this in Rio, but they are doing it now. And the Scotland and Welsh and Northern Irish FAs agreed to do it. And I wonder if that came up in conversation. I have to believe it did. Like, hey, if we don't field the team, it goes to France. And here's a way that we can grow the game over here and at the same time give a big up yours to France, which we know the English like to do.
Oh, they're reveling in it.
Yeah, they will again this summer go and try and become the first team to hold both the Women's World Cup and the Olympic gold medal at the same time. Meanwhile, on the men's side of the game, what I can only imagine was a tune-up for the Olympic qualifying tournament. The U.S. men beat Costa Rica 1-0 on Saturday in L.A., putting an end to their January qualifying camp. A, should we care? And B, is this preseason, this January training camp, worthwhile to the teams anymore? Because they went to Doha for 20 days, ostensibly, according to the press release, to get to say that we wanted to get a feel for the facilities. But most of the guys who went are not likely to be on the World Cup team should they qualify. And all it managed to do was take players away from MLS training for a month for this friendly that only less than 10,000 people watched. I think announced attendance was only 98,000. If you saw the highlights on TV, it looked like far fewer than that.
Well, I think it was held at the, what was it, the tennis center? I think that's where it was. So I'm not sure they even had that many.
I don't know if that was accurate, because why wouldn't it be at the soccer stadium next door? It wasn't like they had a game going on there.
It's true, yeah. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know what? I'll put it this way. I didn't know the game was coming on until, Coach D, you texted everybody. And then when I was like, oh, let me see what happened with that game, and I typed it in, and the first thing that pops up is the women's game. So I was like, oh, well, clearly that wasn't very important at all, because, you know, the women's game probably does carry a bit more weight right now. But the women's game, it hadn't even started yet. But that popped up. It was like, hey, yeah, they were playing. I was like, oh. So the is it important right now?
Yeah,
Go ahead, G. Yeah.
No, I was just flipping through the channels and like, oh, there's a USA game. Like, I had no idea. But for the women, they would advertise it. They would, you know, have commercials left and right about it, you know. But again,
yeah,
it is spring training, more or less. And they had a bunch of no-namers, and they barely won.
Right.
It was just,
yeah, you know. I think rightfully so. I mean, you should highlight the women's game. Yeah, rightfully so. But there wasn't really many players on the squad. The tournament this summer is not necessarily a tournament that's going to be big for the men's side. And as you said, Mike, I mean, they just kind of, like, sent out a bunch of permission slips, and whoever's parent signed it first, they were allowed to go to Qatar. So, I mean, should we really be paying attention to it? You know, I looked at the lineup after the game and didn't really recognize many of them, and said, you know, okay, well, I hope they had fun. I mean, Yazzie's artist is on the squad, and he seems to be the main striker right now. So, it's kind of like, it is what it is. And, you know, I don't think it'll mean much until we start getting back into qualifying again.
It was 14 of the 25 players that were in the training camp are age eligible to go to the Olympics. Although I believe even with them, a number of the players that would be included in that tournament for the Olympics, and I'm thinking mostly of the likes of Tim Weah and Josh Sargent and Tyler Adams, aren't included in that because their Bundesliga teams don't need to to release them for this. I thought it was good to give those kids a run out in a competitive match.
Agreed.
In the USA shirt.
Yeah, I agree.
And
I agree.
Even though it was a mostly domestic-based Costa Rica team, surprisingly, that team actually did have quite a few number of caps. I think on average, it was like 50 caps for the players on the field. So while it wasn't the strongest Costa Rica team, it also wasn't a bunch of like complete and utter knobs. So I think it was a great experience. I was happy to see Ulysses Yanez, the U19 Wolfsburg player who got the lone goal, and he looked good. I also found it funny watching the highlights and watching the replay of the game that it was the senior players, Paul Areolas and the Giassi Zardes, who actually were like the least impressive of the crop of players on the field. But
well, we've been saying to play the young players for a while now, and you know, I'm glad they subbed like as many guys as they could into that game. But you know, yeah, give the young boys some run, man. See what you got, especially on a game that doesn't mean much.
As we get into the last little bit of time we had together, the Friday last, the transfer window slammed shut, and it was surprisingly inactive for a lot of time, but then you had a couple of teams scrambling. Arsenal, Man United, are you listening? At the last minute. I wanted to see who you guys thought had a good window. Among the moves, Inter picked up Christian Eriksen and Victor Moses and Ashley Young, continuing their trend of picking up players from Manchester United and using them to actually win games. Gedson Fernandez and signing Stephen Berwin. Your team, Cedric, got your team, Arsenal, got Cedric and Mari on loans.
Mm-hmm.
Surprise, Chelsea, despite having the transfer ban lifted, signed no one.
No
so
one.
So do you have a winner? Do you have a loser? One that you're interested to see one from the English window or just any team in general? Beyond Erling Haaland, who we talked about earlier and we know is the clear top pickup of this window. What do you think, Coach G?
G?
Silence is G? I guess not. What do you think, Stead?
Yeah. You know, the Man United deal worries me a little bit. Were they able to sign Bruno Fernandes, or did that actually not work?
No, they signed him. He actually started and played all.
That's right. He played. That worries me a little bit. Mainly because, you know, it seems like a move to fill a void right now. But you know, it might work out well, especially if you're looking at, I mean, you know, the guy's midfielder and you're looking at possibly Pogba moving on this year and him being injured whenever he seems to just be disappointed in something. So it's that could be a good deal. I applaud Arsenal for at least trying to do something to shore up that defense because they have 117 draws this season and they have to do something to be able to hold the lead. I think Chelsea was wise to not necessarily move Olivier Giroud because I think Inter was Inter trying to get Olivier Giroud? I think it was something like that.
Yeah.
I think it was wise to not move him on if he did not have a valuable replacement because even though Giroud's not starting. I mean, his record off the bench is phenomenal, and he's a great teammate, and he's a worker. So, you know, you want guys like that in your squad. So, I'm even though Chelsea signed no one, I'm not necessarily thinking that was a bad move, mainly because they did not necessarily move someone that would have been detrimental to the squad. So, but yeah, it was relatively quiet, which I was a bit surprised by, but I mean, the only big splash seemed to be done by Manchester United. And, but seeing as how both of our respective fandom and our squads are producing right now, I think any move that seems to bring some sort of fire in can't necessarily be a bad thing, especially when Manchester United has the cash for it.
I was a little bit iffy on the Bruno Fernandes move until I saw him play on the weekend, and I thought
mm-hmm.
that he was a creative player. He was able to make some passes that I hadn't seen anybody on the team make in a while, but what
mm-hmm.
really struck me about him was he never seemed to stop moving the
okay.
entire time that he was on, which has been something that I've complained about is this. Sometimes how the midfield and they'll just stop and wait for the ball to
mm-hmm.
come. He would pass and move. And he was getting into spaces. He was looking to pass. He was looking to pass the ball on. He wasn't afraid to take a shot. He had a couple that from outside the box that were speculative, but, you know, kind of, hey, I'm going to let you know I'm capable of doing this
mm-hmm.
so that
mm-hmm.
you know you have to defend it. And setting him up for – he looked like a smart player. He also looked
mm-hmm.
like, so he looked like an upgrade at that sort of number 10, number 8 position.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's a player who could, in the right system of 4-1-4-1, a 4-3-3 sort of formation, play alongside of a Paul Pogba and
mm-hmm.
actually complement them very well because he would be a guy who would get the ball and then look to return it and also
mm-hmm.
take that responsibility for driving the ball downfield that Pogba doesn't necessarily like to do and
mm-hmm.
open up the space but to operate should Pogba be there. If Pogba's not there, then I think that he gives them certainly an upgrade in that over the likes of Andreas Pereira and Jesse Lingard. So I wasn't upset about that. I think the Odion Ighalo one was kind of surprising, but if you're just looking for a straight up, we've got to get a body in here,
right,
then it kind of makes sense. He's a proven goal scorer. He's available on the cheap. We know that he's not part of the plans. He knows that he's not part of the plans. It's just cover. And
mm-hmm.
you can say, okay, you should never have let go of Pogba, but again, and it hinted of desperation as they were fighting to find players to bring in a striker, but it was also, you know, when you have a Alexis Sanchez, when you have a Romelu Lukaku on the team, you have to play them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't not play them. And mm-hmm. that was part of the problem with that OGS had with those guys was, like, I don't want to use you in that capacity. Agallo is going to be perfectly happy to sit on the bench and become a break glass in case of emergency option behind, mm-hmm. like, Rashford when healthy, Martial, if he can get back on form, and Mason Greenwood. You know, he is the fourth option at best. Is
mm-hmm.
there anybody available who was going to fill that role? Certainly had Haaland said that he wanted to go into Manchester United, that would have been a no question, and he would have moved up the pecking order and played automatically. But when you can't get that player, what do you do? And if you just need a body, you go out and you go to China and you rent a rather large Nigerian with a proven goal-scoring record. And
mm-hmm.
I was surprised that they were able to actually get it done. But overall, I think, you know, I was kind of – it's hard to negotiate a transfer, and we say it all the time. Most of the time, the ones that get done are the player really wants to leave, and I think even the Bruno Fernandes one didn't happen until he himself came out and said, like, hey, this absolutely needs to get done. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't understand the whole entire paying thing because basically all they did was just return after negotiation and say, okay, we've let this go for a month. Now we're just going to give you what you want.
That's right.
So as far as the player, I'm okay. As far as Ed Woodward's negotiating tactics, once again, I'm left unimpressed.
Yeah.
I'm so glad we had this time together as we start to roll out these stuff. What are you looking for as the week goes on?
You know, I always seem to highlight the kind of the upcoming game that looks exciting. And, you know, even though Premier League is on a winter break, it's still the Premier League, and they're not going to deprive people from paying them to watch games. So they still have four games on this weekend, though none of them seem to be the most exciting games. But if you actually want to tune in to, I believe, Fox Sports this weekend and check out the Bundesliga, you have a pretty good game with Bayern Munich playing RB Leipzig, who are now 1-2 in the Bundesliga. So you have, and it's only a difference of 1 point. So if Leipzig could pull off a win, they could actually bump and get back in the first place again, even though Bayern is on, you know, wonderful form right now, winning the last five. But at least, you know, hey, that's a game that I think I'm going to kick back and check out, especially in the post-Super Bowl sadness of no football. At least on Sunday at noon, I have a nice game to sit back and watch. So I think I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, Bayern's on a really solid run for him. Meanwhile,
mm-hmm.
Leipzig is scuffling a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's come to be sort of the thing that we expect from Bayern. They come back
right
from Christmas break. They're getting goals. Robert Lewandowski is knocking them in for fun. It is a clear top of the table match. If Bayern wins this game, they go up 4 points, and you start to see that separation.
Mm-hmm.
And that puts fear, I think, into the rest of the Bundesliga. When Bayern gets a little bit of separation at the top of the table and you have to chase them,
yeah,
it gets hard to reel them back in.
Mm-hmm.
At least if you're leading, you know that you have to win and you can put the pressure on them to slip up. But
mm-hmm.
if you're waiting on them to slip up, it just doesn't happen, especially late in the season when they've got
mm-hmm.
the bit between the teeth and they're moving on and they've got the opportunity to win, what, their 9,452nd straight championship. It's absolutely
yep.
bananas.
Mm-hmm.
The great thing about that is you can watch the Bayern RB Leipzig game and then switch over, I believe, to ESPN Plus if you can stream that, and you can
mm-hmm.
put on the Milan Derby at 2:45.
Oh, that's a good idea. I think that's exactly what I'm going to do. That is a great idea. Yeah. The Milan Derby. That's going to be a good one. I like that matchup. You know, AC Milan has been trying to do something to make themselves relatively, a player again, because they've really fallen down from where they were just, 10 years ago, which is sad because I've always been had a soft spot for AC Milan. So, and Inter's playing well. This will be a good derby game to watch.
AC Milan, again, oh, how the mighty have fallen.
Absolutely. That's
back in
bad
eighth
ownership
place,
right there.
Struggling to get into just even into Europe again. And the story of their failure recently is one of just tragedy. And we complain about how Man United and Arsenal are doing. It could be worse. You could be a Ross Neary fan because it's just been a horrible decade for them. But, I think that sounds like a plan. So, as we leave this podcast for the evening, I want to take an opportunity once again to thank our sponsor, Playing Against Heart and Fiddle, 4844 Cornell Avenue, Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for live sports and entertainment. If you choose to come out and watch said RB Leipzig Bayern game on Sunday, great place to do it. If you want to watch some of the Six Nations, also a great place to do it. I want to thank producer Paul for keeping us on, keeping the trains running on time. Great job as always. And thank our guest, Coach G. Always fun to talk to him. Stead, any parting words of wisdom this week?
Rugby, rugby, rugby.
England took one on the chin against France.
They did. And I watched it. That was something else, man. They got some big dogs on that team.
So, all right. Today's word of the day, edification. Edification. So,
I know that word.
Once again, for producer Paul, Stead, and the cast of millions that calls in for us, I'm Mike. This has been the Two Guys Soccer Show. We did fair to middling this week. We'll get back on form and suck again next week. This has been the Two Guys Soccer Show. Thanks for listening.